You don't have to ask,
do you?
That's the great John Coltrane with Equinox, recorded in 1965. Of course, Coltrane on saxophone, McCoy Tyner on piano, Steve Davis on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, September the 19th, and on Capitol Hill, an uncivil war among Republicans, with House Republicans accusing party members in the Senate of sabotaging their hardball tactic of tying a stopgap vote to fund the federal budget with a measure to defund Obamacare. Things come to a head tomorrow, so we'll see how that turns out. We'll conclude our discussion on rethinking mythical notions of democracy today in the second half of the program. But first, a very troubling lead story. The Congressional Black Caucus holds its 43rd annual legislative conference in Washington, D.C. this week. The four-day conference, which began yesterday, looks at legislative and policy issues that affect the African American community in particular. A special hearing is scheduled for 3 p.m. tomorrow under the auspices of Representative William Lacey Clay, the congressman of Missouri's 1st Congressional District, and vice chairman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. The hearing is called to bring attention to an insidious plan by healthcare providers to aggressively market the dangerous injectable contraceptive Depo-Provera to women of color, not only in the United States, but all around the world. Our guests today, Kwame Fosu, Policy Director of the Rebecca Project for Human Rights, and Dr. Randy Short, Social Justice Minister and National Spokesperson and President of the Clergy Coalition, will tell us more. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, let me start with you, Kwame Fosu. Could you tell us what the issue is?
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
Yes. The issue here is about Depo-Provera and the pervasive administering and marketing and promoting of Depo-Provera to communities of color, especially low-income communities in the United States and in all emerging markets in the world. Africa is a major target, and all Southern Asia, and also South America and the Caribbean. This drug is it's a contraceptive shot. It's a progesterone contraceptive that is given to women every 3 months. And how this drug is marketed, it's marketed as a convenient drug for women, so you don't have to remember to take the pill. However, what they do not tell women deliberately are the serious side effects. These are lethal side effects. It doubles the risk of breast cancer. It also increases the risk, significantly increases the risk of HIV/AIDS, heart attacks, and many other issues that my colleague, Dr. Randy Short, will continue to talk about.
Well, I want to ask a question relative to your title, actually, and
yes.
Your title is Policy Director for the Rebecca Project for Human Rights. The assumption
yes.
I'm making is that this particular marketing effort you see as falling within the purview of human rights. How so?
Yes. Well, this woman have the right. They have an inalienable right to know, to consent to any drugs that they use. That right is being denied black women. By denying black women that right to know that this drug has these lethal side effects so they can knowingly consent to the use of this drug, that is denying women access to safe contraceptives. And in denying those women these rights, that is a human rights abuse. And moreover, also a civil rights abuse when government institutions are part of this scheme.
Dr. Randy Short, you are the president of the Clergy Coalition, among other things. It is a bit surprising, I must say, to have to talk with a member of the clergy around a subject that most people do not associate with the clergy.
Well, I think that perhaps they may not make that correlation, but you take a group like the American Conference of Catholic Bishops, they're very active. So I think that many people, if they put parameters on that don't necessarily fit or are not necessarily correct, then they might assume that clergy have nothing to do with these issues. But think about it. Clergy are there for christening. Clergy are there for marriages. Clergy are there for funerals. Clergy are there for counseling about surgery and so many other things. So what men and women of the cloth do touches every aspect of life for the people that are their parishioners or just people that seek their counsel.
Well, that's a very progressive position and a refreshing one, actually. Could you tell me what your particular concern is?
My concern is women. Women are half of humanity, half of all the wisdom, and in fact, without that very special half, you as a woman, you're a porthole of creation, of supernatural well-being for humanity. If our women are not well, if our women's rights are violated, if our women are given bad food or bad drugs, if our women are not treated as sacred and special and unique to be died for if necessary, we're in bad shape as human beings. And as believers, we're supposed to love women like we love God. So if I love God, I have to be concerned. And this drug is bad for women, and I'm concerned.
Going back to you, Dr. Kwame Fosu, the issue is being raised tomorrow before the Congressional Black Caucus's legislative sessions. What are you hoping would be achieved there? What are you hoping to do?
Well, a number of things. First, we have to bring awareness to our people and our progressives, because this issue, this crime, this human rights abuse, is mostly being perpetrated by our own progressives. These are people at Planned Parenthood. These are people who believe in human rights and democracy. However, when it comes to Depo-Provera and lethal contraceptives like Norplant, Nexplanon, and these long-term contraceptives, all of a sudden, we seem to lose our perspective of civil rights and human rights because there's another agenda. And the agenda here is, and these are eugenic agendas, is basically to reduce populations of black people. So what we want to accomplish is what Israel accomplished when it decided to protect black women in Africa in Israel only in February of 2013 this year. What the Israeli government did, first, they ordered a moratorium on all Depo-Provera prescriptions. Second, they made sure that any woman who is being given Depo-Provera signs an informed consent form. This informed consent form is required before insurance payments are made to the doctors. So that's the beginning of this discussion. And third, we would like this drug to be withdrawn from the U.S. market, just as the other Pfizer contraceptive Norplant was withdrawn from the U.S. market. And also would like to make sure that in all emerging markets, women do not use this drug anymore. There are more safer contraceptives that women can use. So our first goal is to bring awareness to this. Our second goal is to institute informed consent procedures so that health providers make sure that all their patients sign a document saying that they know about the side effect.
I'm very much interested in something you just said about this the crossing of the paths between what you are advancing in terms of a race consciousness and what the so-called progressive community's response is. How do you resolve this? What is the nature of the discussion that you're having with Planned Parenthood and other so-called progressive organizations that are nonetheless, in your view, advancing what you seem to be suggesting is somewhat genocidal in consequence?
Well, let me say this. The progressives who are doing this are a very small group. They're mostly white women who are progressives who are basically fighting us. All the black intellectuals and civil rights leaders, Professor Charles Ogletree, Reverend Marcia Dyson, Eric Dyson, everyone knows about this drug and they support our cause, and that's why we are moving forward. As black people, we don't take a second, we don't have a second class status in America. Obama is president of the United States, and even if we are intimidated by progressives who are supposed to be our friends, we will still speak out loud about this dangerous contraceptive. So what we have done is we've tried to open a dialogue between Planned Parenthood and all healthcare providers with facts, because at the end of the day, facts is what, you know, is going to sustain our argument. We've provided them facts from the National Institute of Health, an experiment that was paid by the National Institute of Health and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. This experiment was conducted by a preeminent researcher called Renee Heffron. She's out of Seattle and works for the Gates Foundation. Initially, when she was given this task to research Depo-Provera's efficacy, they thought she would come up with a conclusion that supports the U.S. Family planning policy. But instead, she was courageous enough to say that this drug is dangerous and should not be used by any communities that have high HIV AIDS rates, because it significantly increases HIV transmission. And the moment she said that, they attacked her. Her own funders attacked her and tried to marginalize her, but she was able to sustain and push back.
So legislatively, what are you asking of the caucus members?
Well, what we're asking, and we've, and this is what's going to happen after the briefings, we'll start talking about different policy measures that we can introduce to make sure this happens. We've spoken also to Congressman Conyers' office. He's the former chairman of the Judiciary Committee, who actually launched this issue, launched our first report, the outsourcing of Tuskegee, at a Congressional Black Caucus conference. So what we're asking is that they introduce legislation that mandates all health providers to provide informed consent forms, sign informed consent forms, to all women who are using Depo-Provera.
Dr. Short, Kwame Fosu said something, and I come back to that point because it was quite riveting when he made it, which was the crossing paths of race and class, and in a sense, the notion of genocide. I mean, basically, that's what it's saying. To use this drug is, in a sense, a form of genocide. You will be killing people. In your particular political ideology and your political persuasion, how do you fit this problem? How do you see it?
Well, I mean, I can simply go with what the Convention on Genocide for the United Nations, targeting a group for collective punishment, or killing even one individual, or destroying a way of life for people, is genocide. International law would recognize what's happening as genocide. The government of Israel, when it was confronted with what was being done with this drug on its black population, they didn't take 10 years. Within days, they said, this will stop. So the government of Israel, if any people have suffered and been through a well-documented, recognized genocide, it is the Jewish people. And this is why they acted so quickly. And actually, to me, I'm embarrassed that America, claiming to be Israel's closest ally, didn't immediately follow suit.
Why the association? Why so preponderant the availability of this contraceptive to people of color?
Well, it's very simple. There are too many of us to certain people. There's an ideology that there are too many black people. I mean, you have eugenics, you've got positive eugenics, you've got negative eugenics, you've got this whole concept that there are superior and inferior races. This thinking runs through the intellectual fabric of the fringe elements of the elite and the society. So it's not new, it's old. I always remind people that even the liberal Benjamin Franklin had an essay that basically said, why increase the black and brown when you could increase the glorious white and red? And Benjamin Franklin in the 1750s thought there were too many black people in America. This is old.
Well, social scientists, or people would argue, and, you know, governmental types would argue, look, we are looking at teenage pregnancy rates, we're looking at risky abortions, we're looking at poverty, and one of the major causes of poverty is too many children, and we're also looking at the fact that it's going to have a generational effect. Why not embrace a method that would responsibly control when and you decide to have a child? Some people would make that argument that this is...
Can I answer that?
Please.
I would love to answer, and I'm going to steal this from Brother Kwame Foso. Depo-Provera is the DDT of birth control. Remember the DDT that killed effectively the mosquitoes and the flies and the hookworm, but it killed eagles, fish, and ultimately people and the raccoons? Depo-Provera is very effective in preventing pregnancy, but it also kills the women too. It is throwing the baby out with the bathwater and hitting the baby with the tub. There are other safer forms of contraception. In fact, I'm a person that believes in monogenesis, that there's one God and there's one humanity. If low-dose birth control pills are the state of art for places in the world like Western Europe, where they have low rates of pregnancy among teens because the young men are encouraged to use condoms and the women are using consistently low-dose birth control pills, and the same is done for the elite classes in the United States, I want no Plessy versus Ferguson contraception. I want equality as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, that we want the same effective contraception for the elite. That's what America's supposed to strive for. Depo-Provera is a step backwards. Depo-Provera is the slave ship contraceptive. It's the back-of-the-bus contraceptive. It's the black-get-back contraceptive. And we should be against it.
And I would like to add to that. This is Kwame Fosu. When we look at public health policy, there are many different articles on this, women in Europe, especially girls in Europe, start having sex earlier and with more frequent sexual partners than girls in the United States and Africa.
Yes, more.
The difference is this. In Europe, where nobody uses Depo-Provera, hardly any women know about Depo-Provera, hardly any woman know about Norplant and other long-term contraceptives that are very dangerous, what they do is they start early with a sex education. And all there's a term called the double Dutch method. The double Dutch method was coined by women in Europe because girls in Europe always use low-dose contraceptives with condoms. They carry their own condoms, and there's no shame. There's no shame associated. There's no stigma associated with carrying condoms. Here in the United States, we do not teach sexual education, and what we do is, after girls started having sex, then we inject them with these dangerous tranquilizing contraceptives, the DDT of contraceptives, to stop pregnancy. So we have it all wrong. We have it all wrong. And if the policymakers are saying, well, you know, high teenage rates and so on and so forth, well, the reason we have high teenage rates is because we are not having enough sex education in classrooms, because teenagers abroad and in Europe are actually having more sex than teenagers in America, but they have the least number of pregnancies and abortions. So there is a fallacy in your argument that we need these dangerous contraceptives to stop pregnancies. What we need is
why has there not yet been a lawsuit filed in with respect to your perspective on this drug and the likely impact it would have specifically on the African-American community?
Well, that's where we're getting to. We're getting to, but what the Rebecca Project does, any issue we take on, we always have a policy solution. This is the first step. I believe that we are reasonable people, and we can reason with friends, with progressives, to come to good solutions. So our first attempt is a dialogue. We wrote a report that has basically been read and praised by many intellectuals, many academics and legal scholars. And now what we're doing is starting this open dialogue with Planned Parenthood and other health providers so they change their policy. If it doesn't happen, then we go to the next step, and then we'll file a lawsuit. We'll file a class action lawsuit on behalf of black women.
Have you been able to document the actual biological impact of Depo-Provera on the specific target population?
Yes. Not only have I documented it, but as I said, Renee Heffron and many other, the American Cancer Association, have documented what Depo-Provera does to a woman's body and how it mutates cells to cause cancer and how Depo-Provera breaks down the vaginal epithelium. Because the dose is so strong, it's so powerful, it breaks down the vaginal walls and makes a woman more susceptible to all STDs. But women specifically who are living in high HIV/AIDS communities become more susceptible to HIV. That research was carried out by Harvard doctors, by Rockefeller University doctors, and by New York University researchers. And all this information is available in our report, and it's available to all the health providers and policymakers who use this in family planning policy. So they know. They know. And this is what makes it more disturbing after we began to uncover all this evidence. They know about this harm, and they've just been silent about it.
The harm so far, I imagine, is it generic, or has it been specific to the African-American woman?
Well, no, the harm is to anyone who uses Depo-Provera. But sure. What we've uncovered as we talk to women who use Depo-Provera, this is the breakdown. It's most African-American women, black women, know about Depo-Provera because when they go into Planned Parenthood or any other health provider, it's the first drug they're given, because there's an assumption made that black women will not remember to take the pill every day. That's the first assumption. And then the second assumption is that when you find a white woman has used Depo-Provera, this is why. One, she is either on welfare, or two, she went to a clinic that serves an immigrant community or a black woman, or a highly subsidized clinic from a college. So mostly college students, you see college students on Depo-Provera because their clinics are highly subsidized.
Why is the federal government, funding these kinds of programs that, you know, have such a lethal side effect to them? Is that something that you're looking at? I mean, the ironic thing is that you will end up having to wrestle with the organizations like Planned Parenthood.
Yes, we're not going to wrestle with them. We're laying down facts. We'll have policy solutions, and if they do not change their policy, because the FDA knows about this. In our report, we got a letter from an FDA investigator called Lisa Stockbridge, who first alerted the world about Pfizer's unethical marketing to conceal harm. So what Pfizer did was very, very intelligent. So when Pfizer realized that they were going to be basically prosecuted by the U.S. government, they shifted all the promotion to intermediaries. These intermediaries are the healthcare providers like Planned Parenthood. So right now, when you see an ad for Depo-Provera, it's usually by a health provider like Planned Parenthood, like Johns Hopkins University, like the Gates Foundation, and so on and so forth.
Dr. Short, you referenced earlier a historical perspective on experiments that have been done in the United States and abroad on people of African descent. And you put this program, this aggressive program, marketing program, in that milieu. Does that in any way, I should say, how did you make that comparison? How did you make that link?
Well, you know, I'm not the one that made the link. There's sufficient research. There's a book, I believe it's called Man's Most Dangerous Myth. I don't always remember the titles, but if you simply look at the whole, any of the literature on population control, it starts in that period of time and goes forward. If you look at the origins of eugenics, this emerges at the same time that English-speaking, white-dominated societies are ending the enslavement of Africans, and now they have millions of people on their hands that they don't want to pay, who have a history of opposition to being ruled, and what do you do about them? And that's complemented by, within 100 years of Charles Darwin, or therein, maybe 110 years, you have an independence movement where former colonies, in this instance of the French and others, where you now have people who used to have their resources taken from them for pittance, who are getting into nationalism, demanding to be compensated. And so the need to develop Africa competes with the need to maintain economic hegemony over the rest of the world by the United States and Western European allies. So what do? You have issues on population that start in the 1970s. I mean, interesting that African states, most of them get their independence between 1960 and 1970, and you get this push to reduce the population in these countries. At the same time, at the movement, at the high point of the African-American movement for justice, this is when President Johnson gets an award from Planned Parenthood and as well listens to a gentleman whose name is Dr. Remit Ravenholt, who believed that black people were lucky to have been enslaved because they would have either been eaten or killed in Africa, convinces President Johnson that it is better for this country to invest in reducing the numbers of people of color within the United States and outside. In fact, the argument was that 1 in 4 women of color in the world needed to be sterilized for American commercial primacy and American national security. It's not my opinion, not my words. They say it. The people who believe this say this quite openly. And I want to just mention to show you how insidious this is. We all remember the 4 little girls and the 2 boys that got killed in Birmingham 50 years ago earlier this week. What many of us don't know is people who are affiliated with these eugenicists were funded terrorism against African Americans because they feared the civil rights movement would wake African Americans up to a larger eugenics project. When the killing of leaders and all didn't work, then look at how all of these things have become such a part of life. And some of the groups that these people were fighting now are funded. And when you talk about Depo-Provera, some of them will agree with you, it's terrible, but are concerned about funding from some of the same bodies that have always been against large numbers of people, in particular of African descent, within the 48 states and the two Alaska and Hawaii. They're too many of us. They say so. This isn't my interpretation. I read exactly what they say.
Well, Kwame Fosu and Dr. Randy Short, we consider this a briefing today, and I'm delighted that you were able to lay the subject out as you have. We certainly will be following it, and my very best hope that when you articulate this program, this issue before the Congressional Black Caucus tomorrow, that you will get the requisite respect and response, which is urgently needed.
Thank you very much. And if I'd like to just remind everyone where the briefing will be, the briefing is going to be on Capitol Hill across from the Supreme Court in the Visitors Center Auditorium, and that's tomorrow, Friday, at 3:30. It starts at 3:30, I'm sure.
And
thank you.
And if I can mention that the report on Defo Provera, as well as other reports by this phenomenal group led by the inimitable Imani Walker, the Rebecca Project, .org, REBECCAPROJECT.org, has phenomenal reports that have embedded links where you can see all the information for yourself. Judge us, but read the report. Share it with someone. Tweet it. Put it on Facebook. This needs to be a national movement for the salvation of women from those corporate interests as well as the eugenicists that do not respect the sanctity of women.
Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take this break and come back to the second half of our program, Rethinking Democracy, right after this. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead on PRN.FM. Well, we talked yesterday about the concept of democracy and why we need to rethink what democracy is. I talked about the fact that most people define democracy, or it is defined for us, largely in the context of voting. So if you're voting, it's an expression of democracy. And we talked about that, the fact that we have to see it in larger terms than that. Democracy being measured principally, at least this is my take on it, you look at democracy from the point of view of the quality and kind of access that the people have to strategic resources of a society. And if it looks like they have reasonably good access to those resources, I guess you could consider it a democratic society. And, of course, the flip side is true. If they seem not to have equal access or reasonably good access to these resources, you can't but conclude that the society is not at all democratic, no matter what the propaganda says. About half of the U.S. Congress and 67% of the Senate are millionaires. In fact, this is the richest Congress ever in terms of net worth, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. And roll call from the Congressional Quarterly just put out its profile of the richest, the 50 richest members of Congress. This is both House and Senate. And the richest one by far is Daryl Issa, the Republican from California, with an estimated net worth of $355 million. This pretty much parallels what's going on in society as a whole, in American society, where, as I said to you just yesterday, according to Forbes magazine, just 400 of the wealthiest Americans together, their personal wealth is greater than the economy of Russia. So increasingly, we have a conversation occurring between two sets of individuals who identify with each other. Because again, the role of government has ceased to be the apparatus that carries out the will of the people. It is not government by the people for the people, it is government despite the people. Government isolated from and insulated against the people. And they will be, since they are the people who formulate and regulate the flow of resources and the availability of resources, that's what the government does, it controls the resources. We have definitively entered a period where there is no real hard line of demarcation between the apparatus of government and the wealth, the wealthy group of the nation, because they're one and the same. So it's really a matter of them having disagreements among themselves as to how to divvy up the spoils. And the apparatus of government is to regulate, strictly regulate these strategic resources so as to benefit first the people who are very much like them. There is no consciousness in Congress except, you know, they talk about it verbally, but there's no real consciousness that government is supposed to be the make the difference, and it's supposed to be the point at which the vision is exercised as to how to improve things so that people could lead a far more fulfilling life, a happier life, and a productive life. Congress is predatory, as is the business sector. Predatory. We just finished a discussion on Pfizer having a very predatory interest in black women. They're not interested in saying, well, let's go back on this contraceptive and tweak it so that it isn't dangerous, or let's just take it off the market altogether. They have determined that this product should not cause damage in white communities, but it very well can be marketed to black communities, and it would accomplish mutually agreed upon objectives: deplete the black community and make a lot of money. And the role of government would be, here, Planned Parenthood, we'll give you some more money so that you can serve, quote unquote, the African American community. This is how it has become. So we have to kind of up the ante on our own political consciousness and see the process for what it is. They will have to justify themselves. They will have to say that what we are witnessing, this horrific show, they'll have to say and explain it, that this is what governing is. You know, they're having a big fight. But it is not productive. It is merely a quarrel as to who will have the greater share of the spoils, who will have greater say in how the spoils are to be divided up. That's all it is. When we internalize this and we get used to the idea that democracy really is about your interests and seeing to it that your interests are reflected, I mean, not, you know, I don't think that the public wants unreasonable things. And I don't think that the demands made are unreasonable in any way. People want a job. that pays a living wage. That's not unreasonable. People want education for their children, a sound education that equips them to compete effectively in the world of work. That's not unreasonable. People want affordable housing. That's not unreasonable. These are resources. And if you examine your wants and your needs, and you see over a long period of time that those things are not being met, that's not accidental, it's intentional. And so you have to, therefore, engage in a form of warfare. You're going to have to say, it can't be because the system is good and we have bad people in it. You have to conclude that the system is bad. The system is bad. So you construct an alternative. What's the alternative? You create your own leadership, I think, is a good place to start. You organically grow your leadership. Your leadership must have organic ties to you and your community. But you always must be, in the end, the guardian of that investment that you're making called the vote. This is very serious business. When you make that investment and you see what they do with it, and you continue to invest over and over and over again, and the results are the same and even worse, then you have to ask yourself two questions. Is it that I'm not getting this, or is it that they're getting it and they don't care? Either way, it's not good. So we grow our leadership, and you organize a vehicle to express that, your desires as a community, and you give the person the job to specifically carry out the number one, the top priorities of your agenda. That's all politics is. And you have to be prepared to, you know, bring down the curtain when the time comes. In the example we heard that in the struggle of advocating against a genocidal program, they have to fight against, quote, progressives, unquote. You see what I mean? They have to fight against progressives. Because suddenly the issue is money. And they will not yield the supremacy of race in order to deal with an issue of class. You see how that works. So they have to be prepared at some point to publicly distance themselves and say, this organization no longer serves a progressive purpose. They have sided with people who are against my community. I can't support that. That's what I'm talking about. In politics, we have to be prepared to make decisions. It may hurt, it may embarrass, but in the end, it's about the interests of the larger interests of the community, the greater good. And you will have to bring the curtain down. You will have to cancel people's contracts publicly and send them home, tell them goodbye. If the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or whatever party is not serving your interests, get out of it. Leave it alone. Go away from it. Form something new. And it is going to be an uphill climb, but that's the way it is. That's life. You may not succeed immediately, but you have to start somewhere. But you have to start credibly. And there's nothing more credible than centering your struggle within the context of the desires and the needs of the people. Martin Luther King didn't ask for a leadership role. He didn't want anything to, he just wanted to finish his studies and assume the role that had been destined for him, which was to go into the church and be the next leadership, next generation of leadership in his Baptist church. That's all he wanted to do. He didn't grab the leadership role. They gave it to him. They came to him. The elders looked around and said, look, we have a fight on our hands. We need somebody who will be able to articulate our cause. And still he resisted. And that's the kind of leadership we don't have. We don't have the kind of leadership that says they're about the community's interests, but the, you know, to separate themselves, the personal need and the ego needs, from the larger issue, which is the benefit of the community. And therefore, his leadership was genuine. Adam Clayton Powell. I don't care what the criticisms were of Adam Clayton Powell. I don't even pay it any mind. Because there was no question as to his allegiance. Harold Washington of Chicago. I don't care what the criticisms are of Harold Washington. There is no question as to his allegiance. We don't have that kind of leadership in plentiful supply today. And partly that is the responsibility of the community. That's us. Because we settle for mediocrity. We settle for the insults that we get. We settle for these average and below average people who haven't a clue about what their communities want. They don't care. The Republicans are fighting because that's the way they do. They fight among themselves, but they're fighting among equals. And they're fighting for spoils. And they will always compromise. They'll always agree among themselves what's the best way to go. Because in the end, they understand themselves to be in charge. And they understand their mission, which is to aggregate more and more power and wealth. So our Congress is no longer to be viewed as a place that does the people's business. You should just bury that thought and move on. You'd be saner. Construct something locally that works and build your government. It could be a block association, but if it functions efficiently, that's an extraordinary form of government. It might be a tenants' association. Same thing. It might be just a study group. Whatever it is, it must be in service of the aggregate good, the greater good, the interests of the community. Anything else now, you should just say, is just not working. But I had this discussion, and I started it yesterday, because I think we need to start talking about alternatives that could work. And even if we have any number of contradictions, we should examine those too. But we have to consider the fact that the system as defined is no longer viable. It cannot and will not do the job. The evidence is in. The evidence is very clear. There are so many people hurting. This whole issue of race, this is America. This is America's deep wound. It will not heal. Racism will not go away. So people have to construct a response with that in mind. We will have to distance ourselves from groups that swear that they can, you know, they're so open-minded. No, they're not. But you can't waste time on a futile effort. The situation is urgent. And you can't continue to repeat the cycle of self-annihilation where you contribute to your own demise by voting for a process and a party that does you no good. Rethink this thing. Rethink your party loyalties. And tell me whether you still hold on to the view that it is important to identify yourself with a party rather than to examine the evidence about the performance of this party over time and the relationship of this so-called party to your misery and the likelihood that it will continue for generations to come. We can stop it, but we have to have the courage to start small but efficient. As the Jamaicans say, "Miliko for Mitalawa," which means I may be small and scrawny, but don't think that I won't put up a really good fight. I want to thank you for joining me today. I hope this program was of value to you. If it was, just drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com or Facebook, Lead Stories with you, Trace Lead. Pass the word to good friends that PRN is where you go for your information, and Lead Stories is your very favorite program of the day. Take care. We'll see each other tomorrow.